9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour is brought to you by Fabaro. Stay tuned to learn how you can win a free HomeKit bundle pack from 9 to 5 Mac and Fabaro. I have a new HomePod favorite feature.
For a minute, I thought you said that you meant you'd bought a new HomePod.
No. Only two in this house of sanity. If you recall, a few weeks ago, I had an incident where I would ask the HomePod questions, and it would say, "I can't do that on HomePod," except using the male U.S. voice, it would pronounce HomePod as HomePod.
The good old HomePod.
Yeah, that got resolved in Mystery OS version whatever it's on right now, the first update to it, though. And then this week, I've discovered a new thing, kind of by accident. I think it just like misheard me when I said something, but I heard it say something that's not correct, which is if you ask it how to get home or to the home screen, it will tell you to use the home button to get to the home screen. And there's no screen nor home button on the HomePod.
Yeah, there's no buttons at all.
Yeah. So clearly, and there's like a different answer for this on like an iPhone 8. We'll say that. And then the iPhone 10 will probably tell you to swipe up. And
yeah, Apple it does. Watch. So will, swipe up and test yeah. it.
And Apple Watch will tell you to use a digital crown. I'm not sure about the Apple TV. And then the Mac will tell you, like, it'll give you a Google search or something. But for the HomePod, like, clearly they just hadn't tested that, and they just like copied over the iPhone Siri database and then removed things. So
obviously they've like used the iPhone or like iOS Siri as a foundation, made that run that on the HomePod, and then just like turned off loads and loads of stuff.
Except for that,
for instance, if you like delete the email app on the iPhone, you can't ask Siri to make an email, so I can't do that for you.
Right.
That's kind of like how the HomePod reacts when you ask it to send email and stuff like that. Like, they've just like retrofitted the iPhone database onto it. And then in this case, they forgot to change the wording, which I'm sure they'll get around to. But quite funny.
to hear your HomePod talk about its home button and home screen. Yeah, that's the next thing I'm looking for like a future. And it seems like they have to do like a software update to change these things. Like that's how HomePod got fixed, was through a software update. So
I think this one they could do server-side only, because the request, it like the HomePod sends a request to thing asking it the question, and then it reads out the answer that it gets back, right? Like it gets back the answer as text and then speaks it locally. I think the problem with the HomePod was that the text that was coming back was actually saying HomePod, like spelled correctly. It wasn't saying HomePod, it was the local speech synthesis that made it sound wrong. So that's why that came through the software update versus like over the air, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, or it's a product leak of the HomePod 2, which has a home button and a home screen.
No, that is definitely the case.
Definitely the case. Speaking of the smart speaker space, this week I redeployed all of my Amazon Echo Dots throughout my home. I had taken them down mainly because I know I wanted to name them, and they were just named in the Alexa app as like Zach's Echo Dot, Zach's sixth Echo Dot, Zach's 12th Echo Dot, and like it they didn't mean anything. It was just automatically naming them by number, which was not useful. And so I put them in like a shoebox and like took them down. And this week I finally got a chance to like go through. The easiest way to rename them was to like deregister them with my Amazon account and then like re-add them to my. It was a pain, but and the Alexa app is still bad. Like it doesn't support iPhone 10. It's still like Letterbox. It's so slow because everything has a load in. But I went through and named every dot, and then I've got like the regular sized Echo and then the Echo Plus as well. And I thought about selling those too, just because it's really like the dots that I'm using. Anything bigger than that is not necessary. But I didn't think I'd probably get what they're worth, so I'm not going to bother. But I went and named each one of them by room, and that lets me address them by their name. So I'm able to use some new features that I haven't been able to really test before. Like drop-in is one where you can ask the dot to specifically like call another room, and it like automatically connects you to it, and then you've got like a two-way audio line. Or if you use an Echo with a screen, like the Dot, or excuse me, the Spot, or the other one with a screen,
Show,
then you can see what's happening.
It's like ad hoc FaceTime, isn't it? Like the other person doesn't have to accept it, just connects the call.
Yeah, and so I've used that, and that's really neat. Like just fun to like say my daughter's room and like drop in, you know, when I know like she's supposed to be asleep, but like I can hear that she's still up, and then say like, hey, it's time to go to bed, and it's like she doesn't know how I did that. It's just like her alarm clock has me telling her to go to bed. Another feature that I've used and actually found useful, like drop in, is kind of clever, kind of neat. All of these things, like the theme for me is I wish HomePod did them, but HomePod has so many other things that it needs to do first. The other one is announce, this announcement feature where you can say, speaker name, announce, and then say something. And like, you know, you can, the idea there is you can say like, it's time for dinner, or, you know, come see me in the office or something, you know, something like that. And, you know, like sending an iMessage or like yelling across the house or like, going across the house is fine, but like just because it's available is like a modern day speakerphone,
Tannoy,
intercom for the house. Like, but they're in every room, so it's actually useful to be able to do that. And it's neat because it's like your actual voice, the recording of what you said, and even on the Echo Dots, the recording is good enough that it plays it audibly throughout your home or wherever, you know, these echoes are. And I found it to be really neat. And that's something that I wouldn't mind HomePod getting after like the 10 other things that it needs so desperately bad. Another thing I want to complain about here is, you know, the new follow-up mode where it listens after your request in case you want to say something else without saying the buzzword, the hot word.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's like we discussed that, and it's like, but it's problematic because it could be triggered by accident, and then you get into this loop of I'm not really talking to you, speaker. But I've been using it on all of them because I do think like it's better to have it on than off, you know, because it can be useful. The problem though is that you need to turn it on for every echo, and it's so slow because you have to go like one by one, let it load in, and it's like all the web in an app that's really slow. But I think it's just such a bad UX there of like how to use the Alexa app and how it's all laid out. And then the last thing to add here for this section is that you know how Sonos does the Sonos One with the Alexa built in. That's a really good Amazon Echo. You can do a lot of things with it with Alexa, but it can't do a lot of these other things. Like I don't think you can do drop in. I know it can't do announcements, at least in my experience so far. Even if I have a Sonos One that can do all of the Echo things, I've found that I also want to have an Echo Dot in that same room to do the other Echo things that the Sonos One can't do. And then you've
that's
got
a bit of a pain.
Yeah, and then you've got two of these, you know, responding to the hot word. And so what I've done is just turn off Alexa on the Sonos One. You know, so
well on that note, I have turned off the Siri buzzword on my phone.
Oh, really?
Because of the HomePod. So the HomePod, I have my HomePod in my office, like next to me on the desk. It's only like a meter away from me at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I like it, and I use it every day to play music. And the Siri, Hello Siri trigger phrase stuff generally works pretty well, right? Because they talk amongst each other, and then the HomePod responds to the query, which while in an office is generally what I want because I'm playing music, right? So that's what I care about.
Yeah.
But even the simple fact of the iPhone screen lighting up for half a second before it works out, like it doesn't need to respond to the request and disappear, like that just got annoying to me. And like I'd be using my phone and ask the HomePod to change song, and then obviously still the Siri would pop up on the phone, and then the modal Siri would disappear, and then you carry on as normal. But even that like 1 second interchange just got like so on my nerves that what I've resorted to is just turning off Siri on the iPhone, like the listening, always listening Siri on the iPhone. And then if I'm out and about and I want to talk to Siri, I go to my watch, because the watch doesn't get accidentally triggered as much when you're at home because the screen has to be on for it to start listening for the Hello Siri word. And then at home, when I'm speaking in my office now, my phone can just stay dormant while the HomePod answers the queries. Now, if that works for me in the situation, because I'm basically just using the Hello Siri in my office just to play music, and of course I always wanted to go through the HomePod, it's not an ideal solution at the wider base, because, you know, what if my situation was different? What if my workflow is different? What if my organization? What if I was somewhere else and I want to talk to the phone? Well, at the moment I can't do it. But because of the primary use case is, you know, playing music every day, turning it off is actually worked out quite well.
Yeah, I think I have it off on my my iPad for the same reason.
Sorry?
I have it off on my iPad for the same reason.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the part of the reason that Amazon and even Google Home to some extent have manufactured this appearance of being better is because they don't have to worry about clashing with, you know, the phones and the watches and all the other hardware that, let's face it, all of our Apple tech podcasters all have. Like, there is an incredible elegance in just having a separate name to talk about something else. And like, you know, if you're saying Echo announced to the house and this, it becomes so much easier because you know it's only going to affect this subset of products.
Yeah.
And before AI catches up to the point where it can actually understand, you know, you want to talk to this or you want to talk to this, you want to do this, and you don't want everything else to like start buzzing around you, turning it off selectively on some things is a pretty good compromise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even in having multiple Echo devices, because they are so good at hearing you, but sometimes it is like with the Dots, whenever I bought them at $30 a piece, it was feasible to put one in each room. Sometimes you'll have a misfire of like the wrong one hears you and you need to realize that like if you redirect your head, then you can kind of aim at the one that you want, but you can't just speak into the air because the wrong one might listen and then you're setting a timer in the wrong room or something. So it's the same issue there. It's just like you're right that there are so few other things that work with Amazon's voices. Assistant that you don't have that clash. I mentioned I think several episodes ago that I originally had a lot of HomePods. Like I was very excited about the product and I gradually ended up with six HomePods.
You went back to a level of sanity.
Yeah, I went back to two, and it was largely because it was probably because of the price. Like just realizing that it was way too much for you know a set of speakers bothered me. But what caused the friction was the now playing screen in Control Center, where you switch between which HomePod you want to address, and there's also Apple TV there. That just does it's just way too dense. It's not dense enough, so it's just way too much.
It doesn't scroll scale well once you have. Like, as soon as it scrolls off the screen, you're. Mm-hmm. Yeah. As soon as you've got enough speakers that one of the speakers doesn't fit on the screen when you present it, it's like, feels terrible.
Yeah.
And all of the bubbles are so big that you need like four devices for it to start doing that.
Yeah. And throw an Apple TV and it's way worse. So that's an issue where the more you have, the worse your experience gets. It's the same way with Apple products. Like, the more devices you have, the more you need to start deciding, do I want Siri to be voice activated on this or not? And actually, like, as you were speaking, I turned off the listen for Siri on my phone because I do have I have it all the time where the phone actually like takes the command because it's just that much closer, and I'll have music playing on the HomePod and I'll send a command by voice and the phone will respond and say, I'm not playing anything right now. And it's like, no, be more intelligent than that, you know. Pass it on to the HomePod that is playing music that you even know about because you can see that. Aside from that, the watch interferes a lot of times, and that's a situation where if you have more of the products, then you get a little bit worse of an experience because they haven't worked out how to properly address all this stuff.
And it's not just about working out which device should answer. It's also about, well, if you could pass requests over, or if the mm-hmm. HomePod could handle more requests, then you wouldn't have the friction as much. Like, if you want to ask your phone to, you know, check your calendar, and then the HomePod accidentally answers, right now it's a real pain because the HomePod can't do anything about it. But if it could answer the calendar request, then it still might not be exactly where you wanted the sound to come from. And it might be a little bit of a niggle, but at least, you know, the main frustration would be gone. So there's this will get better from many different angles. Like, it's not just about working out, you know, the Hello Siri stuff and which device and which context. Because that's never going to be perfect, right? Like, even humans wouldn't be able to unambiguously decide which device is going on to answer every opportunity. Mm-hmm. But also about being able to switch between devices, or even if the HomePod said, I can't do a calendar, but your iPhone can. Do you want me to do the iPhone calendar? And you say yes, and then it can move it along. Like, there's different workarounds and compromises and in-between states that I think Apple will definitely get to, but it's just all not there today.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about, on the topic of HomePod, this Bloomberg report that says Apple has lowered its HomePod forecast and has cut back orders because of a lack of sales. It specifically says that by late March, Apple asked, Inventec is the company that builds the HomePods for Apple. It asked them to make less. And another thing it adds is that during HomePod's first 10 weeks of sales, it eked out 10% of the smart speaker market compared to 73% of Amazon's Echo devices and 14% of Google Home. This is based on Slice Intelligent. And it says 3 weeks after the launch, weekly HomePod sales slipped to about 4% of smart speaker category on average, the market research firm says. They even say that some Apple stores reported fewer than 10 HomePod sales a day. This is all in the context of HomePod was released without AirPlay 2 and multi-room, you know, playback, and without stereo pairing, which were both shown at launch. And HomePod is only available in 3 countries so far, which I think that's the only limitation of like hardware that's only in 3 countries. We see that for a lot of times for like software features, like Apple News, for example. But HomePod is only in the US, the UK, and Australia, and that's a lot of the world that can't buy HomePod right now.
Yeah, and the UK and Australia are relatively small markets.
They're like states within the US, right?
Yeah, exactly.
They're tiny.
And this pie chart of percentages is comparing, obviously, it treats, you know, a $50 Google Home Mini in the same ballpark as the $350 HomePod, right? So yeah, like the market share is going to be flooded by those cheaper devices. Like, you've got what, 6 dots, even probably more. Like, so
12.
It's not a clear picture there, right? And I'm not saying that we should just discount all the cheap products because Apple's only fighting in the high end market, but there's context around the numbers.
Yeah, I also think that the fact that we've not gone through a holiday quarter, so they obviously wanted to have HomePod out, maybe not by Christmas, but in December, that was the first goal that they announced, and then they missed that and ended up being early February. And so we've not gone through the holiday quarter where you can buy HomePod as a gift. And I think like $350, I do think that $350 is steep for what HomePod is today. If Apple, you know, treats it right and makes it more capable, like as capable as iPhone even, and then slowly starts to match, you know, features from other smart speakers, then $350 feels less bad. But that price point, like $350 is kind of premium, but it's not out of the ballpark of like buying this for a gift for a holiday. And, whereas I think like, you're not going to do that with the iMac Pro for $5,000, but $350 is reasonable. It's like,
yeah, like I think Apple Watch, like the price. Holiday season, families would, you know, consider buying one to have like the shared present, for instance. You know what I mean? Like, people come around, they're like, we bought something for the whole family to enjoy. Here it is, and we'll plug it in and listen to some cool songs on it and stuff. Like, and as it, I think at the moment, like it's rough, right? Because you've got the segment of the market that's looking for smart assistant features, and then you look in the segment of the market that's primarily looking at speakers. And I think one way you can look at this pie chart is, well, the Sonos One's also listed at 2%, and then across this particular period, which does include the HomePod launch, obviously, the HomePod's at 10%. So then you could say the HomePod's doing 5 times better than the closest Sonos competitor. So on that basis, it's like, well, it's doing pretty well.
Yeah.
it's there's many different axes, and it's hard to like directly say that it's bad because it's not dominating the industry. I think you have to think about what did Apple expect it to do out the gate versus what it actually performed at. Like, they are cutting orders, but was that, you know, part of the plan from the beginning? Like, I don't think they could have expected people to. There was a huge pent up demand, you know, release. I think this report says they sold 1 million of them in the first like 2 weeks, and then 1 million more like over the next month and a half. And then naturally, if you're going to be selling less month to month, you pull the orders back. Now, I don't think that's a particularly exceptional finding, right? That's kind of what you expect to happen. So maybe this is perfectly within Apple's guidance, and they're gonna be fine. Like, they're, Apple doesn't share numbers, which means all we get is these analyst speculations, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, my aunt was asking me about like smart home stuff, and I always say, you know, I give her my advice to try and make sure it worked with at least HomeKit, and then ideally everything, so that you can have some choice there. And then I've got, you know, some favorites within those options. But she was asking about Echo, and I said, well, she's all in on Apple stuff for the most part. Like, they have Apple TV, she has Apple Watch, she has iPhone, has iPad, Mac. And I said, well, Apple has, you know, their take on that now, which is the HomePod. And it's also a really good speaker. And I mentioned the price to her. And it isn't that price is like disqualifying. She just thought it was way too much for what she's looking for. Like something, she's like, well, we already have speakers that are really good. Like we've got a home theater and this and that. And so I just want the smart stuff, the smart assistant. It's like, well, okay, I get it, but.
I mean, Apple doesn't offer anything in that market at the moment. That's the simple answer.
Yeah, and I hope they do because it gives them even more reason to put effort into it. Like, imagine if we get to WWDC and there's just nothing for HomePod because it's an accessory and not like a platform. You know, there needs to be so much for it. And you know, I think if there's a cheaper one, then there's more market acceptance to it, and then Apple has a reason to put work into it. Because you could argue that Apple shouldn't worry a whole lot about HomePod right now, because you know it's not going to give them the business that it would get.
Financially, that's the argument. But if you think of like strategy and product, like, yeah,
it's like why bother if you're not going?
Yeah, exactly. Like then you wouldn't release any new product. You'd be like, well, it's never going to sell out at the start.
Yeah,
and that's one of the things that one of the big quotes that Eddie Q said at one of these interviews a couple of years ago. It's like, if we measured ourselves against the iPhone every time, we'd never make another product. Like, mm-hmm. we'd never release an Apple TV because it's never going to compare to the sales of an iPhone, or we'd never do the Apple Watch. Like, the Watch didn't kick off hugely until probably even last year. Like,
yeah.
So you have to give these things like time to grow, and you can't expect iPhone level success out of this stuff. Like the HomePod, as it stands today, the only people that are going to buy it are people that want to subscribe to Apple Music.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Like, if you already subscribe to Spotify, it may be relatively frictionous to move over, but people aren't going to do it. They'll be like, subscribe to Spotify, I can get this $99 Amazon Echo, it'll play some music. Very few people are going to, until you hear like a HomePod in person, you're not even going to be few people are even going to say the Echo sounds bad. Like, that's the reality. Like, unless you hear, I think if you hear the HomePod side by side with a cheaper Amazon Echo, you're going to go, right, if I want to play music, then I should, shell out for the more expensive one. But most people in the world, most of the 40 million paying Apple Music subscribers at the moment won't even have heard a HomePod in real life. So they don't even know if it's worth buying. Like, there's a lot of barriers to entry here, and I think it's going to be a slow burn. And obviously getting stuff like AirPlay 2 for stereo out the door will help. The holiday season will be good. And then, making the smart system stuff better, it all adds up. Like, it's not one roadblock, is a mountain of many different things.
Yeah, and those 40 million Apple Music subscribers are in like 100 countries. They're across 100 countries, whereas HomePod is only in the three that we mentioned. Now, didn't they say at launch, whenever they actually released HomePod, that there were going to be, I think, two more countries, France and Germany, if I'm not mistaken?
That's spring.
In the spring, right, which is, like, that's got to be soon, before, July or so,
Yeah, like you'd normally expect it like this month.
Yeah. So maybe that will happen soon.
They sold 3 million HomePods roughly by now, and there's 40 million potential market of Apple Music subscribers.
So that's a good way to go.
Almost 10%. Not a bad penetration.
Yeah.
The number about like some Apple stores only selling 10 per day. Well, it depends what store you're talking about. Like, if you're talking about a little mall, 10 per day of a HomePod is pretty good. Like, that's average to good. If you're talking about like the flagship Fifth Avenue store, then it's going to be probably, not so good. But then you have to count it online. You have to count in all sorts of different things. Like, if it's 10 for the little stores in the shopping malls and little department store stuff, then that's pretty okay. If you talk about the other bigger stores and they're only saying 10, then it's not probably doing as hot, but the article doesn't go into detail as to which that comes from.
My very first job was working in a mall at a Sears retail store in the electronics department, selling mostly TVs. And I was always amazed that my shift was always like, it was a part-time job, it was after school and high school, and I was always amazed that someone in like my community, like small town, bought a new TV every day after like say 3 o'clock. It never failed. This like there was really a day where I would go without selling at least one TV. And think about like the 10 HomePods per store like a day kind of thing. It's like it's a different thing, but I was always amazed that at least one person would buy a new TV every day within those hours. you know, but like I said, without, there's not a lot of context in that HomePod description. So who knows? But obviously they want to sell more. I did notice last week in that when the story was going around that at one point in the day, Best Buy was sold out of HomePods, at least for the Space Gray version. And then they had stock again. So I don't know what that means, but at one point they were sold out for part of the day.
Yeah, I think adoption has been okay. I don't think it's been blockbuster. I don't think it's been terrible. This is just purely anecdotal.
Yeah.
looking around the market, right?
And I think
the bigger problem is that a lot of people have bought it and then been disappointed by it. That's the bigger problem, I think.
Yeah,
like,
that's true.
Out of those million people that bought the original, bought it on day one, I don't think there's 99% customer sat like there would be with an iPhone or a watch and stuff. So
that's
the bigger problem, I think, is not how many did they sell in this 3-month period. It's like, do people actually like them and are interested in, you know, the product line?
Yeah, I think whenever stereo support comes out where you can pair two together and then you have left and right channel, I think that will make such a big difference in people being impressed with the sound, at least, because with the Sonos One and Sonos Play One, you know, that's around $200. And then you buy two for $400, and it's just way better sound, especially if you're doing it in like sides of the room. Other sides of the room, where the music is distinctly stereo. It isn't just louder, but it's also just like a fuller effect. I get a way better experience with doing that with Sonos. And so I just know that with HomePod, because I tried it with doing, you know, hacking it with a Mac, you kind of get the effect. I imagine it would be a lot better when it's actually supported, you know, from iOS. But it's just, I mean, there's a reason that stereos are stereos. You know, people bought home stereos before with two speakers because it's a much better experience than just like one kind of mono but meant to fill the room small speaker. So I think that'll make a big difference in terms of like it being a serious audio product as well. It also becomes a $700 speaker and not a $350, but you know, hey. 9to5 Mac Happy Hour is sponsored by Fibaro, the makers of UL-certified smart home products that guarantee a reliable HomeKit experience. 9to5 Mac has teamed up with Fibaro to offer a special HomeKit bundle giveaway, which includes four products valued at over $250. Included in the bundle is Fibaro's door and window sensor, which detects contact, tampering, and even temperature, motion sensor, which changes color based on temperature, flood sensor, which detects leaks, tampering, and temperature, and the new HomeKit version of the button, which lets you assign up to three actions, including HomeKit scenes, to different clicks. To win this HomeKit bundle, just look for the giveaway link in the show notes or on 9to5mac.com, and check out this week's installment of HomeKit Weekly to learn how to put HomeKit sensors to work with automation. Our thanks to Fibaro for sponsoring 9to5 Mac Happy Hour. All right, let's shift gears here and talk about Apple's effort to ramp up preventing leaks, in part by using legal action, and we know this because of a leaks memo. So this was a Bloomberg story published last week. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so Bloomberg got their hands on an internal memo that was circulated to seemingly everyone inside Apple. So the fact that it leaked out is funny, but probably not too unlikely, because I think even like this was just posted on the dashboard that Apple Store employees can see, so it's not like it was tightly released. The whole point of this email is Apple wants to spread it far and wide and send a message out to employees, not to talk to press, not to talk to journalists, not to talk to financial analysis, and talk about upcoming products and releases. And this echoes a lot of what we heard from the middle of last year when Apple held that like internal presentation when they talked about they'd hired people from MI5 and the FBI and that they don't want stuff to be discussed outside of the thing because it ruins it for the teams that are working on it. And you know, are following that thing, we had the HomePod leak, we had the iOS 11 GM leak, we had numerous bits in between, and this time they've kind of strengthened their stance a bit. Like they said that they caught and fired 29 leakers from within Apple campus last year.
Right.
29 is a high number to me. Like, even if you had one leaker per story, and obviously normally a leaker is going to contribute more than one thing to a publication. Even if you had one leaker per story in, like, the worst case, I'm not sure there were 29 exclusive scoops from within Apple's campus last year. But,
right,
you know, maybe it's hard to count some of these things. But that seems like a lot to me. But anyway, that's what Apple says. They said they caught and fired 29 people, and then a subset of those they even took to court and prosecuted them further.
12 employees out of the 29.
Yeah, so about half. And that's for, you know, corporate espionage, leaking personal, leaking private data and all that jazz. But the point is, they're spreading this around to the employees to double down on the fact that you shouldn't talk. You shouldn't talk to journalists. You shouldn't talk to 9to5 mate. You shouldn't give tips and stuff.
Yeah. And this follows a similar episode around this time last year, I think, where Apple had a presentation, an internal presentation last summer, where they made a claim that they've tightened up the supply chain and that now most leaks come from within Apple's campus. And this is kind of like stage two of that, is to say, and we're firing people in waves and arresting a portion of those when it applies. And part of what the memo says is that you'll have a hard time finding a job, you know, if you're fired for being a leaker. So, I mean, they're really – that's like the annual version of this, but they're really pushing it hard this time. Now, in my coverage of this story, one thing I included for context is the fact that we still know a lot about what's coming, like, this year. So KGI Securities analyst Ming-Chi Kuo, this is largely based on supply chain stuff. He says that we'll get three new iPhones, the 5.8-inch OLED like the iPhone X, 6.1-inch LCD, and a 6.5-inch OLED iPhone later this year. Now, those are the kind of things that I consider like the big leaks, like what are the new iPhones that are coming in the next year. And we haven't gotten to a point yet where, unless he's wrong, where it isn't given that that's what's going to happen, you know. We've not had that yet, and so they.
Yeah, I mean, and it's that the iPhone is Apple's most popular product, and it's going to be the hardest one for them to lock down and make nobody hear about, because the iPhone is at such scale that they have to start doing preparations now and even earlier. They have to get production tests through. They have to do manufacturing tests. Even some components they're going to start building sooner rather than later. Like apparently, some of the OLED screens are actually going to start being manufactured in June because they don't want a repeat of last year where the iPhone 10 didn't come out till November. Like they want to be out in September, so they're even pushing forward production schedules and some stuff. And just because the iPhone is iPhone scale, that's always going to be the product to leak out the easiest, I think. Like if you look at the rest of Apple's product lineup for this year, we don't have a very clear picture on stuff. And even on the iPhones, we haven't seen like the schematics, diagrams and exact dimensions and things that we've normally seen by this point. So I don't think it's not entirely invalid. Like there is some truth to them locking it down, at least at this point in the year.
Yeah, well, I mean, another KGI story is that Apple is considering a cheaper HomePod, which from your coverage, I think you correctly wrote that that likely means that he's seen evidence of a prototype version of that, but not orders be placed for that. So I don't feel like it's changed a whole lot from like year over year of what gets leaked. And then on the software side, like Bloomberg has that you know famous report of Project Marzipan, which I think is a big deal. Axios had the report about Apple slowing down some software features and kind of giving permission to let things wait until the following year, so you don't have a repeat of like AirPlay 2 and you know Apple Pay Cash and iMessage and iCloud.
Yeah, that was a huge story where they said like a revamp to the home screen is not coming until next year, and then the iOS 12 will have more of a focus on performance stability to answer recent complaints. And that was the story that was on Axios, and we'd actually got like an anonymous tip about it the week before, but we kind of discounted it, and it turned out to be, you know, perfectly accurate. And this was a meeting that was tightly held. It wasn't like this memo, which was literally distributed to everybody inside Apple. This was a pretty small meeting, and this is actually that leak is actually addressed straight out in this email, saying that we found the person that reported on this and that went to the press about it, and he's no longer with the company.
Yeah, he or she. So I some of this stuff is funny to me. Like, I feel like that leak would be a perfect controlled leak. Like that if corporate wanted to send a message, you know, Apple the company wanted to send a message that, hey, don't get your hopes up for a major release this year, you know, community that follows this stuff, because it's going to be like, we're listening. We're gonna give you what you want. We're gonna give you stability, and don't expect these major features. And we'll get
yeah. That was the bigger like controlled leak element of that. Like, if you wanted the spin was, you know, we do hear the complaints and we are doing stuff about it.
Yeah, and then to give you time to process that before WWDC, and then of course, you know, based on this memo, it wasn't a controlled leak, and someone actually was fired over it. And I think that there's like some value in leaks, not just, you know, for our stories, but for Apple the company. Like, imagine if the iPhone 7 came out and all people were talking about for months after it was debuted was not how, you know, anything that was better about it, but it didn't have a headphone jack. Instead, we had a year to process that and talk about it. And whenever the iPhone 7 came out, that was old news. So some of these leaks, I think, are worth, like, leaking. I mean, leaking other companies have, like, other manufacturers, like, phone companies will give people, I think will like, gin up leaks to get press attention, you know, hype up a launch, you know. So I think there is some value in that.
Now, yeah, some leaks have good elements, right? But yeah. Obviously you want that, if you're Apple, to be controlled by you, not controlled by the whims of employees going out of their own and talking, you know, to a website that hours.
Yeah. Do you think that there are controlled leaks these days? Like, or is that never a thing?
I do think it happens occasionally. But I think generally you can tell, like, you can... There's a very strict format to it, and it shows up in certain places, and it's like
the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and not our tips and box per se.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good summary. And yeah. I think there's the nature of some stories that are like, well, this would make sense that they're going to do it. And then, although, like, for instance, this one with the performance stability focus, yes, that bit of the story is good PR, right? But I think the other bits in that story included a revamped home screen was coming this year, but now it's coming next year.
That's true.
Big updates to the iPad were coming this year, and now they're coming next year. And if it was a controlled leak, those details would have been left out.
That's
because
true.
Those bits are bad. So, yeah. Like, that analysis and looking at basically, if you read the rumor and the only way you can interpret it is, oh, this is all good PR, then that there's a much higher chance of that, you know, being slipped out in a nice little birdie somehow.
Right.
But when you have, like, the bad PR, there was bad sides to the Axios story that,
true,
if it was controlled, it wouldn't include those details. It also wouldn't include information like Craig Federighi held a meeting to say this isn't this. It'd be much more indirect, like, sources familiar with the matter indicate that Apple is focusing on performance and stability for this year's release, blah, blah, blah. Like, there are definitely tips of the trade to kind of, like, eke out at things. And I think Apple uses the strategy sparingly, but they do use it maybe, like, a couple of times a year, for instance.
You know, these days, there's more of Apple not even doing, like, a controlled leak to Wall Street Journal and New York Times, and more of, like, them doing, like, say, the Mac Pro, you know, a single person roundtable with TechCrunch to say it's not coming this year, and attributing it to a specific person at Apple, and then giving you the story, you know, and then including the part about the workflow team. But, like, that could have been a control leak before, whereas now it's like Apple saying it directly. Now, the thing I found interesting about them referencing the Axios story, without saying Axios, they just referenced the meeting. They said something about the roadmap was leaked. That confirms the report. Like we got it in our tips box, and my reaction was, wow, that's a big story. I can't confirm it, you know, and I'm not that kind of a reporter who has sources like that.
Yeah, I remember we discussing it, right? Like,
yeah,
this is like about a week before it came out on Axios and later Bloomberg.
It was like a Friday night, and it came into our tips and box. It was like, there's nothing that you could run without confirming. And it
was completely anonymous to us, so we couldn't follow up with him and get proof or anything like that.
Correct, right. So, in which we have to imagine is how it went elsewhere too, and then Axios was able to confirm it, you know, and ran the story, and then Bloomberg ran it as well. So, you know, this memo references that, which is like the first confirmation, you know, aside from other reports that was real and that this is actually happening. Of course, they didn't plan to leak the memo, but you have to imagine it will. But I found that quite interesting. Now, they do reference Nintendo 5 Mac in the memo, which was kind of notable.
We're the only called out publication, actually.
Yeah, and I think it's a lot of stuff attributed to Mark Gurman, who is, you know, who publishes at Bloomberg. Because they say a blogger at Nintendo 5 Mac, and I think they mean Mark Gurman in that. But they also kind of like throw in, and they say AirPods, which he had before he went to Bloomberg. He published the very first AirPods story before the name at Nintendo 5 Mac. Now, they also mentioned like iPhone 10 and iPad Pro, and I'm not sure kind of what they're referencing there. A lot of the iPhone 10 stuff was known because of the HomePod firmware that they posted on a public URL. and then, you know,
with a home platform, they literally released it, but yes. Obviously no device could install it, but it appeared on one of those like over the air firmware websites, and yeah, people just downloaded it instantly,
right, and unpacked it. Now and they do mention the gold master of iOS 11 leaking to the press, which I think, again, like the Axios thing, that went out to a lot of places. We ended up being, I think, the first and only site to really like
get. Yeah, we had premier coverage of that. There's no other way of saying it. We had the picture of the cellular Apple Watch with the red dot. Very rare you see final product images of an Apple product before it's out, but the Apple Watch Series 3 was on our site at with like 3 a.m. my time.
Yeah,
exactly. We had an emoji. We had all stuff about the carriers on the watch. You had the wallpapers from the iPhone X, like the black wallpapers. Loads and loads of stuff came out of that leak. And that was what, like the weekend before the actual keynote.
Yeah, there was the portrait lighting camera effects. Like, and all of this was by the help.
Confirm the name, iPhone X. That was in there.
Just on how to pronounce it. We didn't know how. Like, even before the event, we knew iPhone like X or 10. We didn't know how we were going to say it until they said it. And then I think everyone kind of hoped X and it was 10. But here we are. But they referenced that and say that that person was fired. Like they say, I think a week after it happened or something like that. Like pretty soon after. So within days. So, I mean, it's spooky stuff to think about. Now as like from our perspective, whenever we receive that, like if we could have confirmed the Axios story before Axios did, like that's what we're supposed to do. You know, I mean, that is our role in all of this, is we are telling the story of what Apple is doing.
I want to call out, relate to that, something specific they say in this, Apple says here, and they say, yeah, in many cases, leakers don't set out to leak. Instead, people who work for Apple are often targeted by press, analysts, and bloggers who befriend them on professional social networks like LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook and begin to pry for information.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know about anyone else, but that is not my prerogative in the slightest. The only time I ever follow up on, like, tips and scoops is when people come to me with it, and then I obviously reply. If I'm just following people on Twitter, that's purely, you know, friendship slash just interest in what they write. And actually, a couple of months ago, some 95 Mac people followed a few Apple employees, and they got like very defensive, like,
yeah,
you know, why are you following me? What are you doing, basically? And, you know, I think there are people in the industry that do this thing where they like just agree with everything someone says and then tries to quote unquote friend them and then talk to them privately about getting stuff out. But at least for me and you, like, you know, we're just people who like talking about stuff, and if we follow Apple employees, we're just being nice, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. No,
I think, like, obviously Apple's, the point of this memo is to make journalists seem like the enemy, right? And I'm not going to blame Apple for pushing their bias on their own memo. I think it's well written from that regard. But I just want to say that's not, you know, that's not normal practice, in my opinion.
I think that probably the best Apple reporters, like the ones that get killer scoops, maybe that is like a strategy. I mean, you know, like cast your net wide. But I also like that we can add from our perspective of actually like seeing this news happen in real time and how it works, is that the iOS 11 leak, that was totally anonymous. Like there was no name attributed to that. No one wanted credit for that. It was sent in a way that you couldn't trace back to the person. There were, like, we were skeptical about it from the start without having to, like, we had to install it on our own phones and thought maybe they'd blow up or something. And this person like used a method of communication that we could say that is the same person. But we don't know who it is, and we never did. We could never reach out back to them again, you know, again. And then, you know, with this Axios, like the story, what became the Axios story, you know, was an anonymous tip in our inbox. And there was no way that we could like reply back to this person and discuss it further. Like that was totally anonymous too.
Yeah.
This,
and sometimes if we can get like a corroboration from somewhere else, we can run it and say, you know, we received multiple tips on this. Or
yeah,
if
yeah.
we see like evidence in software, then we can cross-reference an anonymous tip we had a month ago, for instance. Say,
right.
We also received information about this a month ago.
Yeah.
But we're not just going to run with a tip blindly, because obviously anyone can write an anonymous tip to the email and send it to us. So, you know, we're not going to fall for hoaxes.
Yeah, and you and I are not engaged in the social engineering practice of like manipulating people and that kind of thing.
Definitely not.
And I mean, actually,
I'll be open. I talk to Apple engineers in DMs, but we're just talking about like bugs normally. Like,
right.
Nothing super interesting, because it's not fair, right? They're people as much as anyone else. Like,
yeah.
And if you, I think if you try and, you know, get secret information out of them unwillingly, they're just gonna, you know, block you and move on with their life. That's fair enough.
Yeah,
I like having a relationship with these people just to, you know, talk about what software they've done, talk about the releases, complain about some bugs that I want to get fixed. Like, that's perfectly fine. That's what happens. But, you know, at least me and you, we're not following people on Twitter to, you know, pry out scoops.
Like, you know, it turns out that if you blog about Apple for a living and you podcast about Apple for a living, then you probably have a lot of interest with the people that work at Apple. Like, you have a lot of shared interests. And so I like those relationships because, you know, you share a thing in common that isn't, like, universal. And it can be, like, it doesn't – at no point do I ever feel like in those relationships that I need to start prying, because I always know that that's like an automatic – we'll never speak again kind of thing. Maybe that makes me like I would be a bad reporter if, like, I was relying on scoops, you know, and not just, like, you know, an interest in this stuff. But yeah, I agree. That part of the memo I take issue with, and I hope it doesn't break any relationships, because I value those. And I like talking to people that I have a shared interest with, like you. So, yeah. Now, shortly after this memo on leaking,
this is classic timing. This is
leaked. We got a tip in our inbox that said, you know, it wasn't like someone at Apple or someone anonymous. It was just, hey, look what I found on the FCC's website. And what happened was, 6 months after the iPhone X was released, it was already scheduled for the information that Apple has to submit to the FCC to release the iPhone, like, legally and have it approved, includes photographs of the iPhone. Now, Apple has a 6-month window where these are sealed, kind of unnecessarily, but about 6 months to the date.
Well, no, I don't think it's necessary. Well, it, for the iPhone X, it would have been kind of because they obviously announced it early. But if this is a normal iPhone released in the same month, September, they would have to submit it before the event. So, in those cases,
these photos could have been public on, like, day one of the iPhone being announced or for sale, and instead it wasn't until early April that they went public.
Yeah, so I think, like, it's like just due process that if you get an NDA or a non-disclosure on them, then it's just like a 6-month window, basically.
Yeah. So what happened was early in April, like, I think even a few days before people noticed this, photos of the iPhone X in gold appeared. And we were quite skeptical about this. It felt like too good to be true, especially with the timing of the memo leaking. But from everything that everyone can see, these are actual photos of the gold iPhone X that wasn't released.
Yeah, all of us in Slack were like scrutinizing these pictures, like, is it Photoshopped? No. Is it a Chinese knockoff iPhone? No. Is, like, this FCC website that is listed on a hoax? No. Is the lighting of the photos making a silver iPhone look gold? Maybe, but then you look at the edges and
the
sides,
ruler,
like, dark gold, and there's no way a light would do that. Like, there's no chance. Like, the obviously the back is like a tint color, just like the iPhone 8, but the sides of the stainless steel sides are very, very gold. Like, and there's no way some yellow light would make the sides look like that.
Yeah. So we were trying to find space gray versions of like previous iPhones to reference this and see, like, what does the room look like, you know, in past years. And it seems like this was the first year that they submitted gold. And for some reason, like, whenever they submitted this, they thought that they'd release gold. And then, you know, for another reason unknown to us, they didn't release this. And there was the KGI story before the iPhone X was released that kind of set the expectations that gold wouldn't be an option for the iPhone X, at least at launch, like, maybe later on, but not at launch, which panned out. And it's just absolutely fascinating to get to see what it looks like without it ever being available. Like, and at this point, you know, we thought maybe mid-cycle Apple would release it, like, maybe with the red iPhone 8, they'd also say, and hey, here's the gold option now. If you haven't bought an iPhone, go reward yourself. But I think we all agree that at this point, it's kind of late in the cycle. And, like,
yeah,
maybe
the time has passed. Really.
Yeah. That it makes sense for this to be an option with the next flagship iPhone, you know, but not now if they're going to do it.
Which will basically look like an iPhone X, so almost the same thing, just a year later.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, like, I was proud that we did our due diligence in making sure that this was not some kind of a hoax. Like, we were trying to find out, how is this a hoax? And, you know, days have passed, and I think the only thing here is that this is an iPhone X submitted to the FCC from Apple, and oops, you know, there it is.
Literally an hour after they talked about not leaking stuff.
Yeah, and I found like in our inbox, you know, a link to, you know, there are services that will email you whenever new things are submitted to the FCC by Apple, and usually what it turns, you know, I think in every case what happens there is that whenever Apple actually announces a thing, then the FCC lifts the, you know, the ban on or they release the information. And so your inbox gets spammed with, you know, here is the FCC listing for the new iPad that Apple just announced. And this happened for the iPhone X, like from I think it might have been in like October, maybe it wasn't quite September, but there was a URL sent to my inbox, our inbox, with a link to go here, but they didn't have all of these assets like they do now. And so it was funny that I think it was sitting around for a few days even, and before it was kind of discovered. Now, I just checked, and if you go to the FCC's website to see these photos, they're still there. Like, Apple hasn't said, like, oh, no, change the photos. I guess it's out there, so.
It's probably too late at this point.
Yeah, what's the harm? But it seems like
I did check with someone that there is a process if you submit a product to the FCC under closed books and then later decide not to release it, you can tell the FCC to delete the files and never release them. So it just seems like Apple forgot, and then they've come out.
Yeah. So our story, like this surfaced, you know, on April the 13th, and it appears that this was made available as recently as April the 2nd. So, man, I mean, imagine if we would have saw this like pre-red iPhone. Like, it's coming.
Looks good. Black bat bezel. Gold sides. Looks pretty cool.
Yeah, I do wonder, like, if I mean, it's anyone's guess as to why this wasn't released or hasn't been released yet. But I do wonder if anyone at Apple, including Johnny Ive, takes issue with gold-colored stainless steel. Like, we know that they're okay with gold-colored, like, you know, aluminum. But how does Johnny Ive feel about gold-colored stainless steel? Because that kind of, like, visually, there's not a difference there between solid gold, like the Apple Watch Edition, and gold, like colored stainless steel.
Oh, do you think it's like betraying the truth of like, yes, this looks like real gold, but it isn't?
Right, exactly. And if you do this gold iPhone, this, you know, actually stainless steel, gold colored iPhone, and the border is stainless steel, then why can't you do that for the Apple Watch, which would look just like the Apple Watch Edition, except it's stainless steel? You know.
Yeah, that is a very, very good point. That's like perfect Johnny Ive. Like, let the product be true to itself and don't pretend otherwise. Like, I love that quote of him where someone asked him, why didn't you put the digital crown in the center? Like, you know, vertically centered of the Apple Watch. And he's like, because then it would look like it was mechanical. It's like,
right.
Okay. I mean, I get it. Right. It would, but equally it would look a bit pretty if it was. But like, to him, that's you know, a lie, basically. Like, it's not real. It's just like a forgery of hardware design.
Yeah, and maybe
in this case, if it went to the FCC, they must have been pretty dead set on making it and doing it. So I would guess that there was some manufacturing problem which made it hard to make a gold stainless steel band in big quantities, so they didn't release it. That'd be more my train of thought on this particular case, because otherwise, if Johnny Ive didn't like the color, then it would never have got to the FCC in the first place.
Well, what happened was Johnny came back from making Apple Park full-time design, and he said, hey, no, hold that.
So Johnny Ive comes back, he makes the product red iPhone with a black bezel. He's like, let's stomp on this gold iPhone. He's taking back control.
Yeah, taking back. Johnny's back. Yeah. So, I mean, but if they do release this, like, say, this year, for example, then I will wonder, like, why don't they do a gold Apple Watch like that? You know, and maybe it's that jewelry is too sensitive to do this imitation stuff. But maybe we're far enough removed from the Apple Watch Edition, the gold version, that they could do this without it being weird. I don't know. although, I would never buy the gold Apple Watch Edition myself, like, at its full retail value. I'd totally buy one as, like, to collect at a much discounted price.
I mean, you can probably find a cheap Series Zero somewhere.
but I do think that, like, as a thing that exists in the world, like, that, I think it was okay. Like, it was fine.
And I think it was cool. It was aspirational, and it was, like, the thing the celebrities wear, and it was, like, you know, that's a gold watch. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Like, there was emotional thing about it, like, oh, you could see in this picture this person's wearing a solid gold watch, like, it's like exclusive. And I know that also put people off, but like, and it didn't really fit with Apple as luxury technology, but, you know, generally it's still not overly expensive that a median income person can afford one. Like, even the iPhone 10, right, is really expensive. No sure. doubt about it. Mm-hmm. But you can say most Americans, like an average, you can save up, even if it takes you a year to buy one, right? Like, you can do it.
Yeah,
it's not out of the realm of possibility. Whereas a gold watch, like, they started at $10,000. Like,
yeah.
Most people on Earth couldn't save that up. Like, it's just not possible. Like, you can't afford a gold watch, like a solid gold watch. I think Apple should bring back the solid gold watch and not have a price premium on it, because I think people, like, and weighed it or whatever, and they found, like, it had, like, $2,000 to $3,000 worth of actual gold in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they should sell it for $4,000 or $3,000. and not do like the jewelry thing where you put a massive premium on it just because you can. Mm-hmm. But like, sell it at what it was worth and have it there. Deprioritize it. I only have a couple of models. But I think it was a cool material, right? I think they should still have it.
I'm more okay with $10,000 as like, this is like, I mean, because they sell the ceramic edition for like $1,200 or so. It's in that range. That $10,000 is outside of what I will buy and can like fathom, but for what it is. But it was also kind of neat that you could also buy like the same exact like technology for $350, in the small limited version. But it's the $17,000 model that makes me feel like unsettled inside, because it's just hard for me to wrap. It's when I think about like the galaxy and the size of the galaxy, I feel like small and like unsettled. And when I think about the $17,000 Apple Watch, I felt that same thing. but like $10,000, like some kind of a premium. And like I said, if it's near at cost, then it serves this purpose of like being luxury still. And I think it was kind of cool. Maybe they will take the opportunity of the Apple Watch Series 5 with a new design to bring back the gold edition. And at every new design, you get the gold version.
Well, like a special edition of the new design.
Yeah, exactly. But the fact that they carried over the edition name when they went down market to ceramic is not likely, though. So, but there will always be that the gold link bracelet that like only like Beyonce and Kanye West and a few other people had that will still be special. All right, let's talk about Apple Watch faces. So over the weekend, Guy Rambo wrote for 9to5Mac that watchOS 4.3.1 includes something that suggests Apple could be working on third-party watch faces in the future, like maybe watchOS 5. It's been kind of Stephen Charlton Smith, who was equally involved in like tearing apart iOS and watchOS and seeing what things mean. He kind of pushed back and said he thinks that that's not quite what this log message means. But at any point, it's a nice jumping off point, point to say we want third-party watch faces, and why not watchOS 5 or any day now. So what do you think about third-party watch faces in that situation?
Yeah, I mean, I want to see them. I think we've spoken about this before, but it's like, to me, still the biggest change in across all of the watchOS releases was when they added the Numerous watch face and the activity digital face, just because they're the home screen of the watch. They're so critical to your experience. If you like your clock face, you're going to like the watch. Like, and if you don't like your clock face, you're not going to like the watch. And if you can't find one, then you're in trouble. And the original, like, watchOS 1 didn't have any, for me, didn't have a great watch face for the smaller screen. Like, all of the analog faces don't work well on the smaller screen, because when the circle inscribes the rectangle, it makes a really, really small circle. So you had to go digital, and in the watchOS 1 era, like, the only good digital face I ended up on was the accessibility extra large face, which at that time didn't even have a complication on it, so it was just the time, and it's like, I'm wearing a smartwatch and I've got the time in big numbers.
Yeah.
And then they added numerals, really stylish, really cool. Activity digital, really stylish, really cool. And they're the two faces that I use the most now. But I want to quench the thirst of like, this would be so cool if I could just have anything as my clock. Like, they have what, 12, a dozen or so faces at the moment, but with an app store, it could be like endless. And you're not just getting the design input of Apple, which all the watch faces are very pretty. I'm not gonna deny that. You also open it up to the wider, market, and you have like an app store for watch faces, and that would just be like, it would just unlock like a whole new potential of the watchOS operating system. And unlike iOS, WatchOS has been built on this kind of like theme of customizability. Like,
yeah.
Even in the original Watch keynote, Cook said, you know, you can, there are millions of combinations, and he was referring to like the different complications you can get, the different bands you can have, the three different, you know, chassis styles, and you can find one that suits your personal style and taste. And that's a theme that they spread across WatchOS. There's a lot of like behavioral UI settings that don't really have parallels to the iPhone. Like on the iPhone, you can't change how your lock screen looks, really, apart from setting your wallpaper. You're still stuck with the, you know, four icon grid, four icon row, you know, rows of four icons on the iPhone. Like, it's a lot more rigid, and it kind of fits the platform. Whereas Watch has moved more into like, you have more freedom. You have multiple options for the home, for the app grid. You can have a honeycomb. You can have a list. You have many different options of watch faces already, and inside those watch faces, there are a bazillion different colors you can pick, loads of complication boxes. If you open the dock, you can have it to show just recents, or you can have it to show, you know, a static list of favorites. Like, there's the watch platform has so many more options for you to like choose between different things to kind of like make it suit yourself. And one place where they don't have that really now is in the clock faces. Like, after you exhaust the 15 or so, how many there are, you know, you kind of feel like there should be more. And I think a lot of people who go into the watch app on the iPhone and click on the App Store button, I think they're expecting to find watch faces.
Yeah.
And you just can't find them at the moment. So to me, adding it is perfectly in line, and I would fully support it. Yes, there is a risk that you get a lot of rubbish and a lot of bad watch faces come along and scammy stuff and, you know, like really shovelware. It's this one, but with a different font. And that happened. They could have stricter App Store guidelines, which require a higher bar to entry. And at the end of the day, market mechanics kind of shuffle this stuff around. Like, you have the best watch faces come to the top of the top charts. That's the idea. And you look at the App Store for iOS, there's plenty of rubbish in the App Store in those millions of apps. You know, there's a lot of rubbish in there. You just don't see it generally because you only see the good stuff, because that's Apple features the good stuff. They curate the good stuff. And then you can see top charts, which, you know, by and large is deselecting the bad stuff and only focusing on the better apps. So
yeah, like the fart app watch face won't be popular,
and or it'll Apple be popular like a day is like the meme.
yeah, but Apple won't feature it, and you won't see it in advertising, and you probably won't see people wearing it in real life. Now something I think about, like recent watch faces that Apple's added, and you know, like the one around the Siri watch face is like, this is our watch face for every app that we do, and they're adding new data sources every time. You know, obviously we'd like to see third party data sources added as well, like maybe even WatchOS 5. But watch faces, like the two activity watch faces, analog and digital, I think that's a really good. Like the starting point there is, let's take the activity app, and what if we could put the activity app as like the first thing that you see when you look at your watch and do the time? And I feel like that's what they do there. And so like, and if you look at like the Kaleidoscope one, they're kind of doing that with photos. Like, would take a photo and make it your watch face, and then you can, and you know, in a creative way. I like that concept of taking like an app and making it your watch face. Now maybe that would be like a bad implementation. You know, like we want third party watch faces for like the visually the way they look, not just how they function. But I could kind of see Apple saying, like, you know, if you want to do an overcast watch face, have at it. It's and whatever, you know, Marco wants overcast the watch face to look like, you know, that's the starting point. But like, that's what
like things
is.
Like, you could have a things watch face, which has a really custom way of showing your to-dos throughout the day. Like, maybe as you go around the day, the hands of the thing change to like a little text description of the upcoming to-do for that time. Like, there's a lot of flexibility there that you can't get with just, you know, customizing a rectangular complication.
The people at Culture Code that do things, the task management app, they're really good at app design. Like the app itself thinks itself for like every platform, looks great, and people love how it, like the interactions work. If you look at their blog, culturecode.com, they have like – they even have like super cool like sketches to like, you know, give personality to their blog posts. They're really good at that. I think they've adapted well from like the realistic skeuomorphic design to flat design, and like mixing up both things and making it look nice. So I could see there being like a things watch face, and it's like analog hands, and just like those activity rings with like progress, they take like one of their pie progress, you know, icons that show you like your progress in like a project. And the more tasks you complete, you know, you're filling a circle basically, like a pie chart. And it could look cool, like a blue theme. And but I know that we also – and the Nike Watch Face is just like that. Like it's pretty much the Nike Run Club app font made into a watch face. Like these are all examples of taking an app and making it a watch face, but it's primarily like a way to view an app at all times, you know, kind of. You know, I think music is a big opportunity there to have like every time you raise your wrist, like album art appears and changes, you know, or something to that effect, you know. But I wonder if people would like, if Apple introduced that as the starting point, if we'd still desire just like purely design watch faces. Like we want them to look a certain way, not be functionally different, but just look different. You know,
I think so. I mean, you look at the current, I think it'd be like the current selection you've got now where you have some which are very appy, you know, like mm-hmm. activity face,
yeah.
Siri face, and then you've got others which are just stylish clock faces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it'd just be that, but with a much bigger number of possibilities for each category.
Yeah. In the past, I think that there has been some value in not having third-party watch faces, because then you push the Nike watch by saying in part, I mean, the only thing really different about it, the Nike watch, is that it has the Nike watch faces that you don't have to use. And you can push the Hermes watch because it has exclusive Hermes watch faces. But really the appeal of that is the Hermes band, which many you can buy on their own. I don't think there's a lot of value anymore in pushing, because they're not making new partners. They're just using Nike and Hermes for that. And so, you know, I think of it, like, there's no reason not to do watch faces anymore. I mean, what do you think of what it takes from Apple? You know, we hope that there's a lot of new capabilities for apps in general, but like, what does it take for Apple to let developers build watch faces on their
side? I mean, that's an interesting question, because if you took UIKit on the iPhone, you can basically draw to the screen whatever you want and do fancy animations and do pretty much anything you can imagine. If you say, you know, if you can code it, you can do it. On the watch side, the current frameworks limit you in massive ways. Like, you couldn't really do a watch kit clock face that's of any quantity of good. Like, the only thing it does let you do is have like an arbitrary context where you can do, like, if you were doing a game, you could draw any pixel you want. But that's not really how these watch faces want to be made. Like, you want something closer to UIKit and free and flexibility, where you can put layers on the screen, you can do compositing, you can do all this stuff with this much richer, essentially, UI framework. And that's what most of the current watch faces are built like. They're certainly not built using WatchKit. They're basically like little iOS apps that just power a watch face and are made by Apple.
Yeah.
And something to that degree to let and support like a rich, diverse, dynamic interactions that good watch faces are known for and would require. Like, you need to go beyond what the WatchKit stuff offers today.
Mm-hmm.
And fingers crossed, if they introduce that clock face SDK, that same UI framework could then be used to make apps as well. Like
good apps.
They could kind of like hit two balls with one stone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe, so, hopefully.
Fingers crossed.
Like, if you couldn't have a WatchKit watch face, it'd be so bland. It'd be like, oh, you can scroll here. Like, the problem with WatchKit is just it's a rigid templating engine, right? Like, and that's not what a clock face app store. The promise of a clock face app store is diversity and difference and uniqueness. Like,
yeah,
none of the you'd still expect Apple to provide some basic templates and like building blocks, like for instance an analog dial or the hands, right? Like, these would be in the library of components that someone could draw on. But at the end of the day, they should have, the developers and the designers should have the freedom to do pretty much whatever they want.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just looking at like Activity Analog and Kaleidoscope, they have distinct Apple Watch hands, like from the first Apple Watch faces, you know, utility and throughout. They have Apple Watch hands, and usually the same like orange second hand. Some of them let you change that, but you know, just put those over what developers can make underneath, and then you've got your analog faces figured out. And then digital, you know, you can be more creative there. But and maybe they have rules like if it's clearly a knockoff of like a designer watch, then that's not.
Yeah,
that's,
I don't think there's any problem with them being more restrictive in what they allow. Like, mm-hmm. on the App Store, you probably. It's such a free for all, right? You should probably just block out inappropriate content and then leave the rest of it to do. With the watch faces, I don't think there's a problem with them being really, really stingy on, like, if this is basically knocking off the activity phase but puts the circles on the right rather than the left, then we'll reject you. Like, I think there's nothing wrong with them being much more selective and picky about this is what you're allowed to do and this you're not. As long as at the end of the day you still have the freedom. Like, basically, they should promote diversity and choice and not just making a copy of what's already there. If the rules are restrictive and then don't allow that, then that's bad. But if it's like the rules are not allowed, you're not allowed to just copy the built-in ones and then make them red and then resell it for £5 each and, you know, put a subscription on it. Like, that, then that's just being like a scammy rubbish. And I wouldn't mind, even as someone who wants to make custom watch faces, like, desperately would love to make some cool custom watch faces and build them and, you know, has the technical capabilities, presumably, to do so. I wouldn't mind if they did, like, a really, like, registered partner program. Like, what if they said, at the start, the only people that can make watch face, third-party watch faces are people that have got an Editor's Choice Award by Apple, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, curate it down and say, these people that we know are good, they can do it, right?
Yeah.
And then they can test the waters. It would basically be like the Nike and Hermes, but with a slightly bigger base, right? You'd have, mm-hmm, like 100 faces. And they could individually vet each one and say, this has got to be really good, otherwise not going to allow it in. And the Editor's Choice apps, in general, have a lot of money and make really high-quality software. And you're going to come together and make something really great. And then maybe you can then relax as you go on and open it up to more and more people as time goes on.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think you have to be stuck log jammed on the idea that people are just going to make scammy rubbish fart apps out of this, or, you know, piles of poo that rotate to show the hour the hour of the clock. Like, I do think there are policies and ways that Apple could do this that avoid a lot of those problems and,
yeah,
and ultimately and most importantly provide more functionality and delight to actual, you know, Apple Watch owners.
Right. All right. Last question. What Apple Watch face are you using right now?
Right in this second, I am using numerals with the rail text effect, and it's blue.
And it's blue. Okay. Do you know what color blue? Because there's like 9 colors of blue now.
It is the dark blue color.
There are so many colors that, like, if you just described them by their title, you wouldn't guess what they were anymore. Everything new, the new band, they make a color to go along with it, and they add up. Like, bands go away, but these colors are not going away. And I think it's kind of an opportunity to, like, clean it up a little bit, because some of them are silly. Like, they're too close together. All right, I'm using the Siri watch face, and I always want to have the weather, temperature, just the temperature, and the date glanceable, you know, when I raise my wrist, because there's so many times where I'm like filling out a form, you know, something to turn in for some reason, and I need a date, and I never wanted to pull out my phone to look at the date when I have my watch. So, but I'm using the Siri watch face, and by default you get the date above the time, and you have the Siri complication, and then your data sources are below that. This week I changed the Siri complication, which doesn't really do anything. It's just like a tappable Siri, but you can use the crown or say the word to make it happen, to the date. And it gives you the day of the week in red, and then the date, the numeral, in white. And it's very thin. It's like, I think it's really nice looking. I didn't realize this was there. And then I changed the top complication to the temperature, and it's like very small with a degree. And I think, like, I've tried this before, and for some reason, like, I think I tried putting the weather where the Siri complication is, and it's like a big blue number, and it looked tacky to me. But this arrangement with the Siri complication on the left becoming the date, and then the original date complication about the time being the weather, I think actually looks pretty good. And my Siri face feels like less nerdy and more like, you know, nice. And then below that, I usually get to see my activity rings. That's another important thing for me, is to see the activity rings. And unless they're filled, I think it's often like the top data source for you. And then throughout, you know, the rest of them change throughout the day. But I went from like only doing activity digital to trying this out, and I'm getting like more information from it because it's the Siri face. And I'm also saying the things that I like in a way that I like. So that's what I'm doing this week.
That sounds pretty good.
Yep. All right, that's the show for this week. If you like the Happy Hour podcast, please subscribe if you don't already subscribe. And share the podcast with a friend. Read us on iTunes if you like the show. Recommend us in Overcast. If you have any feedback, you can email us at happyhour@9to5match.com. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at ApolloZach. Benjamin, you are?
I'm at BZAMayo and not on Instagram.
All right. And also follow 9to5Mac. And with that being said, we'll be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye.